This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Turul Mende, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Jonathan Smolin about his work on A Nose and Three Eyes. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Maybe we can start with the first question that you tell us about yourself, how you ended up where you are basically right now.
Sure. A long time ago in college, I was studying the ancient Middle East, and then I started studying Arabic. And that just was, an amazing experience. So started studying Arabic, went and lived in the Middle East, North Africa for a number of years, went back and did a PhD in modern Arabic literature and culture, and then came straight from that to Dartmouth College.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. And when did you first read A Nose and Three Eyes, the novel, and what were your thoughts about it?
Well, if you don't mind, I'd like to backtrack for a second, because really the origins of this project was actually when I started, when I was learning Arabic in the 1990s. So I had this amazing professor. His name was Farouk Mustafa. Allah yarhamu, he passed away, but he was just this amazing, amazing Arabic professor. And he taught us how to read Arabic through the short stories of Ihsan Abdul Quddus, the novelist, the writer on this novel that I translated. And Ihsan was this amazing stylist. He wrote melodrama in a way that was exciting and thrilling, and you really wanted to get to the end of the short story or the novel, which is perfect for learners of Arabic. And when I was learning Arabic at the time and learning how to read Arabic through these short stories, I remember our professor saying that it was absolutely terrible that no one had ever written about Ihsan, that Ihsan was this legendary writer. He was the most popular and prolific writer of Arabic in the 20th century. And no one had taken him seriously as a writer because he was, the critics had seen him as this writer of melodrama and popular, but not of high literary quality. And I remember him saying that, Ihsan was this unique lens through which to understand Nasser's Egypt, and that there was this loss that no one had ever really studied Ihsan seriously or taken him seriously. So years passed. I went and worked on Morocco. I published a book about police and popular culture in Morocco. I translated a bunch of modern Arabic novels from Morocco. And then around 2017, I decided I really wanted to do a project on Egypt. And I thought, well, clearly someone has done this book about Ihsan. I mean, it's been so many years. Someone has done this. And I went and saw that he was still being ignored by critics, both in Egypt and abroad. And so that's when I went and kind of went back and read all the novels. And so read all the fiction and kind of went back to it, but with really fresh eyes, coming from not just years and years and years of living and working on Morocco, but also just, a lot of years past. And so when I read that novel, it was really eye-opening for me, because it was really a moment at which I understood what Ihsan was doing with his fiction, the way that he was using fiction on the one hand to tell these incredible, heart-wrenching stories of romance and failed romance, but on the other, the way that he was using these from my perspective as allegory and metaphor for the nation's failed romance with Nasser in the 1950s and 60s. But I'm happy to go into the details of that more later.
And why do you think was he ignored by critics and others during his time and later on?
Yeah, so it's incredible. You know, again, he was the most popular and prolific writer. I mean, there was a AUC, the American University in Cairo, did a public opinion poll in Egypt in 1954. And Ihsan in 1954 was already the most popular writer in the Arab, you know, according to them, more than Mahfouz, more than Tawfiq al-Hakim, more than anybody, Atta Hussein, more than anybody. And there are a lot of reasons why he was, you know, kind of ignored by critics. One of them, or, you know, some important factors are that, first of all, he was commercially very successful in ways that others were not. He wrote with a kind of simple style. And this is one reason why teachers of Arabic love using his fiction to teach non-native speakers how to read. His vocabulary and sentence structure and content is seen as unsophisticated by critics, but still very crisp and cinematic and easy to read. I think that those are two really crucial, you know, elements. But also, he was seen as a trailblazer for his depiction of sexuality. So he was labeled at a very young age as the writer of the bedroom, the writer of the bed, meaning, you know, that he was kind of very sexual in his writing and kind of purient, you know, in terms of the public's interest and fascination with him. And so that gave him this reputation as someone who was successful and popular and entertaining, but not necessarily of high literary value. I argue all of this is wrong in that he, you know, to understand him is to understand the fact that he was the editor-in-chief of Rosal Yusuf magazine, which was the most important political and cultural magazine of the mid-20th century in the Arab world. And he was, and everything he wrote was serialized or published first in that magazine. So he was focused on circulations. He was focused on sales. He was focused on building an audience of readers, you know, through the magazine that would be, you know, eager to get the next installment of the novel, you know, in next week's issue. And that's also where they would find the political debates of the day, you know, political debates about democracy and rule of law and cultural debates. And so for him, fiction was not just something for sales and circulations and popularity, but it was really something that was about building an audience that would come back to the magazine for, you know, to be able to read or to read the kind of political and cultural debates. And fiction was a vehicle in order to achieve that. So when you only read Ihsan as published books, you miss that entire crucial original context for his writing.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. And what can you tell us a bit about the person himself, about Ihsan? What kind of person was he, and the context when he was writing An Oath and Three Eyes?
Yeah, so he was a living legend. Certainly by the time when he was writing this novel, he was a legend. He really rose to popularity in the 1940s as this kind of fire-throwing journalist who was calling for revolution and was intensely anti-monarchy and against the political parties. And so he participated with Gamal Abdel Nasser and Anwar Sadat and the other free officers before the coup to drum up public anger at the regime, at the monarchy, at the political parties, in order to lay the groundwork for the revolution or the coup that would come in July 1952. And so he saw himself as a partner in some ways with the free officers. He was the only civilian that Nasser called on the day, the morning of the coup, to participate in the coup. He was there with them and participated in all aspects of the coup. I cover this in a book that's coming out. And so, you know, afterwards, he used his platform in Rose of Yusuf to try to push Nasser to implement democracy and rule of law and democratic reform in the country. And so he quickly became a kind of thorn in the side of Nasser. And so by 1954, Nasser jailed him. And it was in the aftermath of that, that, you know, a direct political critique became something that was impossible for him. Like, as you know, in the magazines, in political editorials, as it was for everybody else. But that he, this is when his fiction really took off. This is when we think of him as this, you know, of what he became as this legend of popular fiction in the 50s and 60s. And so who he was as of 1963 was the editor-in-chief of the most important political and cultural magazine. He was someone who wrote a big best-selling novel that was first serialized in the magazine, you know, at least one a year, sometimes more. Many issues, any given issue could have a chapter or installment from some long serialized novel, a short story, a political editorial, and the cultural comment, you know, and so he would write all of these on a weekly basis. So he was someone that was, you know, a superstar of fiction and culture. He was also, you know, the most important classics of Egyptian cinema were based on his fiction. So, you know, Omar Sharif and Fatin Hamama and Lubna Abdul Aziz, all of these, these legends of Egyptian cinema really became legends because of acting in films that were based on his fiction. So, you know, he really is in many ways the most important figure or the kind of pillar of popular culture in Nasser's Egypt in the 50s and 60s. And so when this novel was first serialized, you know, he was truly this legendary figure.
Thank you so much. And let's get a bit into the book. The book is divided into three parts. And what does each part tell us about the story, about each perspective of the story?
Yeah, so the book is, you know, in order to understand the book, first of all, you can read the book in two completely different ways. And I want to, you know, be clear about that. You can read it just as, you know, as the plot goes. It's a perspective of three different lovers of a doctor. Each of its kind of successive relationships, there's a tiny bit of overlap between the lovers. And the way that the doctor is a kind of collage, is a construction from the perspectives of the three different lovers. And each of them are labeled by an I. So first I, second I, third I. And you can read it as, an extended romance that goes, or, you know, in a sense, a failed romance that goes from the early 50s up until 1963 or 64, right? That's a time of serialization. And that it encompasses this in many ways the most important years in modern Egyptian history, the Nasser period, and told from this perspective of human love and loss and the tragedy of heartbreak. And I don't want to in any way underestimate the importance and power of reading it just along those terms. But there's another reading for this novel that would be very hard to understand without understanding the context in which it's written, which is that, you know, he's serializing this novel. He's not like Naguib Mahfouz, who wrote his entire novel and then chopped it up and serialized it, in a newspaper. Ehsan went in and wrote each chapter the night before the magazine went to the press. So each chapter, each installment of practically all of his fiction was written on deadline. Now, he had a card, you know, or he had an outline of where he wanted to go, but each chapter was written hours before it went to the press, you know, in 90 or more percent of the time. And so what this does is it gives us an opportunity actually to think about the way that the installments are interacting, are intersected with other things that he wrote in each issue of the magazine. So going back and reading him, not as published books, but as chapter by chapter, installment in each individual magazine, and beginning to link each installment up with What did he write in his political editorial? What did he write in his cultural editorial? What was happening in his personal life helps transform how to read this, you know, any of his fiction. And I make this case in my book that's coming out in the fall on him, but it, you know, in this book in particular. And so seeing it from that perspective, that he was someone who felt that he had participated with the free officers, had kind of felt a personal sense of responsibility for bringing them to power, and then felt a deep sense of regret for what happened, in that they turned out not to be Democrats, but that they instead, Nasser in particular, installed military dictatorship. And so from that perspective, the novel can be read as the three distinct phases of Nasserism that happened, you know, up to the point that he wrote this. A first phase of a kind of widespread romance in which there is, you know, the public embraces him and sees him as a form of kind of redemption. There's a kind of l'amour fou, so to speak, right? A kind of crazy love for Nasser that you see in the first part, which leads to a sense of betrayal and crushed love the main character of the first eye has given everything to this man who has in return betrayed her. The second eye can be seen as this kind of messianic phase of Nasserism, in which he becomes this almost like a prophet, almost like a kind of messiah figure, a kind of larger than life figure that has transformed and brought the Egyptian public back to life in a way that seems metaphysical, and that is, you know, later criticized by people like Tawfiq al-Hakim as a kind of bewitching, but also as a kind of, you know, messianic experience. And then the third part, which is where the lover is Lebanese, which is, you know, a thinly veiled double for the northern province or Syria or Sham, when Nasser chased after unity with Syria. And of course, you know, there was the United Arab Republic from 1958 to 1961. It's that third eye where the main figure, the doctor or the Nasser double, becomes weak and kind of chases after in a self-deluded way, a kind of union with the north and the Lebanese girlfriend, but is this double for the northern province. And so in a way, the novel could also be read as the history of Egypt's experience with Nasser in three very distinct phases, all of which, in a sense, end with tragedy. And in a way, this is, you know, the novel could be read as a kind of auguring of what's on the horizon of the June 67 shattering catastrophe of the loss to Israel. And in many ways, you know, Ehsan saw the degradation of the Egyptian state at this point and the rotting out of Nasserism, you know, a couple of years before, you know, the ultimate, shattering in June 67.
And were there any characters that stood out for you in the novel, or that you maybe could identify yourself with them?
Not on a personal level, but, you know, there is an incident that I think is really important for understanding why, you know, the doctor would be a double for Nasser. When Nasser jailed Hassan in 1954, Hassan was in jail for 3 months, and he was released, you know, without explanation, and he left his jail cell after 3 months of just a absolutely horrible, miserable, torturous experience. And when he returned, as soon as he got home, the phone rang, and he thought it was his mother welcoming home. He hadn't seen his wife and two kids in a long time. And instead it was Nasser. And Nasser called and said, you know, "Have you learned your lesson yet, Hassan? Come have lunch with me and we'll talk." And so for the next month, he forced Hassan to come to his house every day for lunch and for conversation. And so after 30 days of having these forced lunches with Nasser, Hassan finally asks Nasser, "Why are you asking me to come to your house? Why are you asking me? Why are you forcing me to do this?" And Nasser says to Hassan, It's because I'm giving you psychoanalytic treatment, Hassan. I'm giving you, you know, this kind of psychoanalytic treatment. And it was from this point on where Hassan begins to write Nasser as a doctor, as someone who is a doctor who is providing, in a sense, psychoanalytic treatment. Now, this is a story that Hassan wouldn't reveal to the public until 1974, which is this wave of denasserization, where you get these criticisms of Nasser. But it was something that Nasser would have known very, you know, would have been obvious to Nasser. And Nasser, in many ways, was Ehsan's biggest fan. Nasser didn't read books, but he did read the press very, very closely. And he followed Ehsan's fiction very, very closely. And so knowing this history and kind of digging this up through, you know, interviews that Ehsan gave later and reading, you know, cultural commentaries, and then people knew him and so on and so forth, you see the way that Ehsan is repeatedly writing interactions and scenes and references for an audience of one, so to speak, you know, knowing that Nasser is going to read this story and knowing that Nasser may intervene. He may be angry. He may be frustrated. You know, he may want to punish Ehsan. And so in my book on Ehsan that's coming out in the fall, I kind of unearth a number of episodes where Nasser does intervene in his fiction, and for it either punishes him in certain ways, rewards him in other ways, or even forces him to change the plot. And so this novel, A Nose and Three Eyes, there's a moment at which the criticism of Nasser really goes too far. And all of a sudden, a member of parliament raises a charge against Ehsan that he's charged with harming public morality with this fiction, with this novel, and that it should be, you know, banned and never be turned into a novel never be turned into a movie or a radio play or a TV series, all of which would later be produced. But that this is in many ways, you know, a kind of side story to the novel, in that while there were other novels that had controversy around them, of course, like Children of Ali by Necky Mahfouz, that Muhammad Shaiya writes brilliantly about in his book on published by American University in Cairo Press. But Ehsan was the first novelist brought before Parliament under the charges of harming public morality through fiction. And it was because of this novel. And you can see the impact of that as this scandal is playing out, as you know, in the later chapters of the book, in the way that he incorporates the scandal in the book and the way that he kind of shifts the plot as a result of the scandal that's happening in real time as he's writing each installment and each chapter of the book.
And when you start translating a novel like A Nose and the Three Eyes, how do you approach your translation, and what difficulties did you come across concerning language or sentences?
So this was an interesting case, you know. So first of all, I translated it from the original Rosal Yusuf installments. And the reason for that is that, unfortunately, in the 1980s, when the book was finally published in Egypt, it was published in an edition that an editor took great offense to the depiction of sexuality in the book, and put an added condemnation of the characters in the fiction, in the text itself. So I saw the original, you know, I originally started reading it as a book that was published in the 80s. And then I saw that this couldn't possibly have been Ehsan writing, you know, and Amina, you know, does this because she's so morally bankrupt. And I realized that some editor at the press had added, you know, clauses and sentences to condemn the characters in the fiction, you know, after Ehsan died, actually in 1990. So these editions would have been in the 90s. And it was shocking to me the way that the novel had still stirred up such intense feelings, that an editor at the press felt like it was, you know, an urge to condemn the characters. So, and for that reason, because later, there were a number of printings of the novel that were marred by these, terrible editions, I wanted to make sure that the novel was faithful to what Ahsen, intended. And for that reason, I translated it entirely from, the actual magazines, not from the books. And so there's the process, of course, of translating it in terms of of writing out the English from the Arabic. And then there's the process of register, of word choice, of flow, of how would this, what if Ahsen had written this book in English? How would it have read? How can this read in a way that it mimics as best as possible his style, his flow, his language choice, everything that makes Ahsen such a magnificent novelist? And so, that's really, for me, what is the, very time-consuming part of the process of translation is thinking about what word in English, what is the flow, what about the sentence length, what about, all of these things about, so that, for me, how can someone read this novel and not feel like it's a translation? Mm-hmm. Read this translation and not feel like it's a translation. Right? That is my goal as a translator. And that's what the kind of process for me is really about.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. And coming back to the foreword in the book that Hanan al-Sheikh wrote, how did it ended up in the novel? And how is it connected to the story, basically?
Yeah, so, I just, all thanks to Hanan al-Sheikh. She was just an absolutely wonderful help for me in this project. So as I was writing my book, this book that's coming out in the fall, I knew that she appears as a kind of double in this novel, that I knew that he based the third character, the third I, on her. And so I reached out to her and asked, would she be willing to talk to me about this? And she was incredibly generous with her time. And, I went to London. I flew to London to meet with her in person. And we had long conversations about her time with him. And then also about her own personal relationship with this book, with this novel, and the way that she was with him when, he wrote these chapters, that she's a character, how she sat with him and kind of saw him handwrite these chapters. And so I then asked if she'd be willing, because she'd never written about this before. She's mentioned it in a few interviews, but she'd never actually written about her experience with Ahsen from 1963, 1964, 1965, but especially when he was writing this novel. And then also her, kind of memories and experiences with him, but also the way that, he wrote her as a character. They had a romantic relationship at the time. And so there were a number of details and stories that she told me that were really crucial for me to help, on the one hand, finish this book about him and to fully understand the arc of his relationship with Nasser. So there's that on the side, but on the other, he wrote her as a character in the novel, and then again that she had this really unique relationship with him. And so I don't want to take away from her foreword. I'm just very grateful that she wrote the foreword. That foreword only appears in this translation. And it's, something that, I'm just really thrilled that she was willing to do. And she wrote such a brilliant foreword for the translation.
Thank you so much. And as realizing now that your work on Ahsen is quite extensive, and what did you learn from him, and how are the translations? You already translated another novel from him. How are the translations connected to your research?
So for me, translation is always connected to my research. So Nose and Three Eyes will be my fifth novel translated from Arabic to English. And they're all, every novel that I've translated is connected directly to my research. Part of this is that I think of a research project as a constellation of work. There's the academic book that it's kind of the anchor, but that It's, you know, because of the field, it's you know, nothing had been translated of Ehsan's before. I mean, it's shocking that the most popular and prolific writer of the 20th century, you could not find a novel of his translated into English. I mean, it's absolutely stunning. There was one novel translated in Egypt, you know, in 1977 or 78, but it was, you know, out of print immediately and completely unavailable. And so, because of that, you know, I felt like how could there be a book that really, unearths the kind of political, cultural, literary importance of Ehsan without there being translations? So these translations are intersected with the book that I have coming out in terms of, you know, supporting, but also, you know, complementing. So for me, translation is always, you know, about, you know, how do I teach what it is that I'm researching? How do I provide, you know, for people who don't read Arabic fluently, how can they engage with the research that I'm doing, by being able to read the primary material themselves, not just what I, you know, write about in a book, for example. So in that respect, it's a crucial component of the project.
And your next book is about Ehsan as well, and the relationship with Nasser. Is it something that is a larger project that you are working on? And what are your next projects, basically?
So I think of this project as the book that's coming out on Stanford University Press in the fall is on Ehsan, but also Ehsan's relationship with Nasser. And what I'm really trying to show is that not only has Ehsan being misunderstood as a political and cultural figure, but also the importance of reading fiction, of understanding culture, not as printed books on a shelf, right? But as culture that's coming hot off the presses. It's something that's being written and, you know, rapidly under, you know, political pressure, under personal pressure. And the way that, you know, what looks to be like popular culture, pulp fiction, ephemera, is actually the crucial way of understanding literature, culture, and politics, certainly during this period. So this is a method that I also used in my first project, and that I looked at in my first book called Moroccan Noir, which is published in 2013 on Indiana University Press. I was looking at the way that newspapers, magazines, tabloids, police fiction, TV cop shows, trials, like sensational trials, about how all of this incredibly popular material also channels crucial moments of political change and political pressure. So intersecting kind of popular culture of police with transitions in the country, in rule of law, in human rights and democracy. The messy intersections between the press, the media, the popular press, tabloids, and large-scale political changes. And in a way, I'm doing the same thing with my project on Ehsan, in that I'm looking at Ehsan not as someone who published 20 novels and 600 short stories, but that I'm reading him within the context of the magazines, of each individual issue, and the way that each installment is interlinked with the politics of the issue, of the moment, of his own personal life, and with Nasser. And Ehsan had this intensely personal relationship with Nasser, in ways that are really stunning. I show that in this book. My next project actually is at a different location. It's in Lebanon. And what I'm looking at there is I'm looking at the way that the Lebanese media reacted to the Nakba, the June 67 shattering loss in the war, in a completely different way from the Palestinians, from the Egyptians, from the Jordanians, from other, you know, other contexts. In Lebanon, there was a mostly uncensored media, and that was unique within the Arab world. In Lebanon, in the aftermath of June 67, the pop cultural response was completely different. There was this explosion of magazines and novels that were intensely sexual, erotic, but they are framing the erotic through sadomasochism, through a kind of masochistic emasculation of the male as someone who, the Arab man who cannot perform, as the Arab man who cannot perform as a parallel for what happened in the war. And the way that these magazines and novels are channeling the defeat through the lens of a kind of emasculation and sadomasochistic fiction, imagery, pop culture, and kind of eroticism is something that is a story that has not been told. This is material that is not in any library in the world. It has not been collected. It wasn't exported. There was a little bit exported to Egypt, but when they did export these magazines to Egypt, they ripped out the centerfolds, and they ripped out the short stories and the material that was particularly explosive. And, you know, as we know, Lebanon doesn't have great archives, but also Lebanon, of course, went through the civil war from 1975 to 1990. So the process of the country burning meant that a lot of this kind of pulp, you know, ephemera media got destroyed as well. So there's not much left of this. So I've been spending, you know, the past decade collecting this as much as I can in Lebanon and Beirut and, you know, in the country, online, wherever I can find it. And I kind of have a critical mass enough of these magazines and novels that are really telling a completely alternative story of coping with the defeat of the June 67 loss, and a story that has not been told and is not known because this material didn't circulate beyond Lebanon. It has not been archived. It has not been collected, with, you know, a rare exception, but basically not been collected. And so I'm very, very much looking forward to showing the way that media, for many, you know, a certain kind of media that for many looks like trash, is actually telling a crucial story of processing this shattering and catastrophic defeat for the Arab world.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. We come to the end now of our podcast. I wanted to thank you for your time and that you were with us today on the show. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure. I really enjoyed it. And keep up the great podcast. They're fantastic.